Ms. Bumgarner?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm here, Ms. Bumgarner.
You've changed.
You have changed. Counsel, have you all, both of you signed in?
Yes, sir.
Give him just an opportunity to... Counsel, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
You may begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kelsey Paragoy, and I'm representing Mr. Jin in this appeal. The case before the Court was a very close one, not necessarily on the facts, which are largely not in dispute in this case, but on the issue of whether or not there was malice, or whether or not this case was a heat of passion case. The record reflects, particularly through Mr. Jin's statements to police after that were presented to the Court by the defense counsel, that his mind was blank. There's a dozen times that he says that.
Those aren't the issues, though, that are before us, are they?
Yes, but they're important issues.
I concede that they're always important, but can we talk about the legal issues involved?
Absolutely. And I know the Court has demonstrated interest, particularly in the second issue in this case, so I'm going to discuss that one first and address the Court's question that was posed to counsel in this case. Initially. So Jin's second legal error in this case was that when the trial court found him guilty of two counts of attempted murder of the same individual, Ms. Zhang, that those counts were improperly charged and they violated his double jeopardy rights. Now, the court posed the question to counsel in this case that whether or not there was a waiver of these rights based on 19.2, 266.2.
I think we asked you just whether that issue had to be raised with the court prior to trial as required by statute.
Certainly, the statute does require that, but we would, in this case, it was appropriate the way that it was raised. Defense counsel made a sufficient argument to preserve it for appeal. And in addition, most importantly, the argument in the record is in his motion to strike, which you can find at around 279. In the joint appendix.
Let me ask you about that. A motion to strike challenges the sufficiency of the evidence, correct?
Yes.
Was the evidence sufficient to convict on either of the two Commonwealth's theories, that an attempted murder occurred with a car or that an attempted murder occurred with a hammer?
I think the evidence would have been sufficient,
Why was that the appropriate time to raise the issue? If this is a double jeopardy issue, the only question is whether he would suffer multiple punishments for the same offense. Why don't you have to wait until he's actually been convicted and punished for two separate offenses before you raise the double jeopardy argument?
Well, there's some, as I'm sure the court is aware, there's some issue in Virginia court's case law as to whether or not that's appropriate. So the problem with this kind of conviction, a multiplicitous conviction, is not the indictments themselves, it's the punishment. So there is an argument that you have not suffered any injury, there is no harm, and there's no appropriate time to object until the point at which you are convicted. That's certainly one way of looking at things.
You agree, don't you, that the Commonwealth could charge alternative theories of the same crime and say, well, maybe the court won't believe that he tried to run her over, but the court will believe that he tried to hit her with a hammer or vice versa.
Yes, I think that's
so
certainly...
Which of these two indictments should the court have struck?
Well, I think it doesn't matter, because I think if you look at this as a continuous offense, it doesn't matter which is struck. And that would be our argument, is that this was one continuous offense. The indictments themselves are identical. So if it had gotten to the point...
The indictments are identical doesn't mean the actual offense or the underlying factors are identical.
Correct.
You see that, because in fact what we have is a short break in time between arguably the two assaults.
Yes, a short break in time that the court even described itself
and
as a short
break. And two different methods of which the assault was effected.
Yes, but what's most important about the two different means, and just because two different means were employed doesn't necessarily mean that that raises two different indictments. That's why the court has four separate factors that it looks at when determining
a continuous offense. But those are two factors that the court could consider in reference to.
Absolutely. They certainly could. In this case, though, the first method was abandoned when it was no longer possible. It was no longer physically possible for the car to drive any further. The victims in this case had moved. They were inside of the building at this point, and that method was only abandoned for that reason.
But at that point, we had an... If the Commonwealth's evidence is accepted on the driving of the car and all of that, we have a completed attempted murder, correct? If nothing else happens, but the Commonwealth's evidence is credited about the way the car was driven, all of it, we have an attempted... We have a completed offense of attempted murder.
Assuming that there had been nothing else that happened after that, I would say yes. But that's not the critical question here.
Stop the timeline right there. We have a completed and attempted murder. If nothing else happens, if he just gets out of the car and walks away, there's enough evidence to convict him of attempted murder. If he does nothing else.
I think that that's reasonable, yes. But that isn't what happened here. And the question for a continuous offense is whether or not there was an unintermittent, uninterrupted impulse that created a series of actions such that fitting the four factors, time, situs, victim, and nature, that made it one continuous offense.
Well,
and those four factors are met.
That if he had tried to run over her with the car and failed, and then went home, and 8 hours later came back with a hammer and attacked her with a hammer, that those would be two separate offenses?
Absolutely. And that's why time is one of the factors that courts recognize.
So we have a continuum in there. Who decides whether this time is sufficient or the other factors are sufficient to determine whether it's one offense or two? Who makes that call?
The court does. The trial court in this case made that decision appropriately.
As a factual finding, correct?
Yes.
So we cannot overturn that unless it's plainly wrong without evidence to support it.
Yes, and in this case it is. This is not a sufficiency argument with respect to these two, but it's clear on the basis of what actually happened on those four factors that this was one continuing offense. So unlike the case that the appellee has cited in their brief, Carter, this is not one that there's 10 minutes, 30 minutes. A break in the events, Carter specifically, was three separate rapes. Right. In between those...
Well, let me refer you to Hodgett versus Commonwealth. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, facts basically are an inmate scooped a cup of toilet water out of the toilet in his cell, threw it on a deputy, turned around, scooped another cup, and threw it on him again. And we held that was two separate offenses. That seems pretty similar to what we have here.
Well, I feel like I would need to know more about that case, especially in terms of timing and whether or not there are any events in the middle of those. Because, and I'll use Carter as an example, there were events in between the rapes in that case. There was an event going to the bathroom was one of the events that happened, escorting up and down the hall.
How about the Supreme Court of Virginia and Stevens? Two bullets are fired into a car in rapid succession. Two charges of shooting into a vehicle. Mm-hmm. I mean, just bang, bang, two different charges, and the Supreme Court said that doesn't violate double jeopardy. That's the General Assembly intended to punish each time you shot into a vehicle. Here we have, I mean, sufficient time for her to go into the Italian restaurant. This is apparently a place where you can go to get all kinds of different kinds of food in Newquin. Goes into the Italian restaurant. Another means is acquired. I mean, there's a lot more to stopping the assault with the car to go get a hammer to go and then beat somebody with a hammer than there is in firing two bullets in rapid succession into a car.
And while I certainly don't want to say that that court was inappropriate in doing so, because I don't know the facts of Stevens specifically off the top of my head, in this case, these things were separated, and the means that were used, that they all fit in one continuous offense. The critical question is whether or not there was an unintermittent force that caused you to go on a series of actions.
That's his intent. I mean, you're talking about, did he have a continuing intent to kill? Right.
I think it's a separate question. This is this is what the courts have Virginia courts have said for continuing offense analysis. So that while I'm sure continuing intent can be, you can consider that as evidence of a if you have the same motive of it being the same force uninterrupted. But the uninterrupted portion is critical. Here we have seconds. We have within feet of where the car of where the car ended up versus where the attack took place inside the back of the restaurant. We have the same victim. No one disputes that. And the nature of these events, the same exact thing was happening, same force. This all happened very, very quickly, as the trial court recognized.
You acknowledged with Judge Petty that if he leaves the scene and is gone for 8 hours, that's sufficient to create a second offense. Where would you have us draw the line?
Where would I? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
8 hours is enough to make it.
I think it's reasonable that you could consider those separate offenses, but I don't think it necessarily has to be. These cases are fact specific, and there's four factors that go into whether or not there's a continuing offense that all need to be looked at. I don't think time is determinative in any one specific case.
Let me turn you to your other assignment of error so you don't run out of time to address that. That seems to be that question in theory presented by the defense attorney seems to me to be at best marginally relevant. In this case, it's pretty much a stretch to conclude that because he was staying at the house owned by the wife that he therefore had a motive to falsify. Could you help me understand how that is so significant it becomes a constitutional violation?
Well, there's two portions to that. First of all, I think it has to be recognized how critical Gao, the individual who was being cross-examined at that point, how critical his testimony was. He is the only other witness that says that he heard Jin say, "I want to kill you," before they left the restaurant, before these series of events started. That testimony was critical. It was so critical, in fact, that the Commonwealth used it in both their opening and their closing. Mr. Gao repeated it four times in the span.
What in the record establishes that he would be unable to live there if the defendant were acquitted?
Well, that's not the question. So in order to really look at this appropriately, I think you have to first recognize that it had already been established that he was living with Ms. Zhang. And not only that, but that it was the question that was posed was whether or not he was paying rent there.
Even if we conclude that the theory has some...
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time, but...
Even if we conclude that theory has some purchase, you stood up at the very beginning and said there's no real dispute about the facts. He tried to run over with a car, he hit her in the head with a hammer. Given that we have that, no one disputes that those two things happened, how is this anything but harmless?
To address that, there's no dispute as to the series of events. So if I led you to believe there's no dispute about any fact in this case, I certainly want to correct myself. There's no dispute that the car incident happened, the hammer happened. There's no dispute over the identity of Mr. Jin. Those sorts of issues that are often in dispute in criminal cases were not in this one. His intent was hotly disputed. Whether or not he had formed malicious, whether he had malice, or whether or not this was a heat of passing.
To think of a friendly way to beat somebody in the head with a hammer.
Well, I certainly I understand the point that the court is making with that, but this was a close case in terms of intent. Malice was required beyond a reasonable doubt, and heat of passion. There was evidence in Mr. Jin's statements, in the fact that it was largely undisputed that Ms. Zhang said, "I want a divorce and I have a lawyer," right before these events happened. So I would take issue with that particular portion. because this is a constitutional issue on this first assignment of error, and I'll wrap up right after this, because it's a constitutional issue, you have to declare that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So whether or not something's relevant is a matter, whether or not it makes any fact in the record more or less probable. Here, this went to bias. Bias is almost absolute. And it can't be declared on the facts in this case that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So I'll end there.
She also put 30 seconds back on her phone. Come back up.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Good morning. May it please the court, Aaron Campbell appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'll start with the first assignment of error. The Commonwealth's argued that the really sort of the first problem with this is of an inadequate proffer. We don't really know what the expected answer, whether he actually did live rent-free at this place. We have this sort of speculation that that's possible that he didn't, but we don't know. So I think it would be really hard for this court to even determine whether or not, if this was error, whether it was harmless.
Do we know who owned the house from the record?
And we don't even know who owned the house. We don't know if it was Zing or we don't know if it was a defendant. We don't know if they rented it from someone else. We just don't know. Assuming, though, for the benefit of the doubt, that this was error, that this would have shown some bias, I would say, Judge Petty, that this was just marginally relevant. The evidence in this case, I would say, it's not close call. I think this was overwhelming evidence that this defendant acted with malice. That just by the nature of the acts of violence that he committed, would definitely show violent malice and intent, and that his argument that of heat of passion was rejected by the trial court. And we also have established already that he was a victim in this case, and his sister was the other victim. So, you know, just one further little possible element of bias, I don't think meets the test, and I think this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, even if we can overcome the what we would describe as an inadequate proffer.
Let me ask you about that double jeopardy argument. Did the Commonwealth waive its right to rely on the statute requiring double jeopardy claims, challenges to be made before trial by not raising it?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because so you have 19.2-266, which if the defendant doesn't raise it in a timely manner in writing 7 days before trial, that's a waiver. I think we've established that. The question that you've asked is, did the Commonwealth waive the waiver? And I would, in researching this issue, I would point the court to the right result, wrong reason cases, the Supreme Court's case in Perry, this court's decision in Blackmun. I would also point the court to this court's decision in Harris v. Commonwealth, which is 39 Virginia App 670, which is a 2003 en banc decision. And in that case, the Commonwealth raised the issue of Rule 3A9, which is the counterpoint to Rule 19.2-266. They are pretty much say the same thing.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a second. There's also, in reference to 19.2-266.2, that even though there's a requirement for the 7 days in terms of the filing, that for good cause shown, the court could, in fact, allow it. So is there any reason that is something that the court could consider when he's making the motion to strike, he being the appellant's trial counsel, making this argument, arguably about jeopardy? Couldn't the court have, at that point, considered that to be good cause shown and listen to the motion?
Yeah, and there's some tension there. I was considering that. I guess if the court is deciding it on the merits, then maybe it's not so much a waiver of the Commonwealth, but the court has decided on the merits, and therefore we can reach the merits on appeal.
Would good cause be established by proof that the counsel was unaware of who the victims and the indictments were, and therefore was unaware that they were the same indictments?
No, I would not say that would be good cause.
Because that appears to be what's happened.
That's exactly what happened.
But we presume that the trial court is familiar with all of 19.2, 266.2, so by entertaining the motion to strike and dismissing it on the merits, do we have to attribute to him a sub silentio finding of good cause?
That is an implicit finding of good cause, perhaps. But I would point to
And you didn't challenge a finding of good cause?
No, there's not one on the record.
Implicit or otherwise.
Or otherwise. I will say that in the Harris case, the Commonwealth raised the 389 argument for the first time on appeal. And this court said, and there was this argument that the Commonwealth waived it, and this court said, no, the Commonwealth can raise it for the first time on appeal. And so I think we can raise it on appeal, though I recognize the tension within the statute. You know, if the court reaches it on the merits, is that a waiver?
Let me ask you about the multiple offenses themselves. I think Judge Russell brought up the case involving the multiple shots into a vehicle.
Yeah.
If the defendant shoots twice at a person in rapid succession and misses, would you argue that that constitutes two offenses of attempted murder, employing the same rationale as in the case involving shooting into an occupied vehicle?
It's difficult. I'd hate to concede that, but I don't.
I think you're wise to.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a very different. That would probably.
I mean, isn't really the question we're looking at is has the attempt of first attempted murder in terms of the overt act ended, mm-hmm. and has another overt act then be undertaken, albeit all with the same intent to kill?
Yeah, when you have two shots, I missed. Okay, I'm gonna try it again. You know, is that two or one?
I mean, that would seem that the Commonwealth's charging authority would only be limited by the magazine capacity of the firearms.
Yeah. So, more than likely, that would probably just be one attempted murder. But in this case, we have, albeit a brief passage of time, we have a number of distinguishing factors in which the trial court can make a factual determination, this is a factual determination. We have hitting the victim with the car, and then the victim is taken inside of a restaurant. There is a point where the defendant goes and gets this second instrument, this hammer, and then goes to a second location, which is inside the restaurant, and starts hitting the victim with the hammer. Under that set of facts, I would say that the trial court was not plainly wrong in finding that this was two separate and distinct acts, and two attempted murders.
The change in mechanism, the change in location, and the passage of time that allowed those two things to change is sufficient.
I would definitely say that is sufficient.
Let me ask you about one thing that I asked appellant's counsel, and it does trouble me in terms of the way this was brought to the court's attention.
Yeah.
I'm confident that our case law says that the Commonwealth can charge the same offense in alternative ways. It can basically say, well, if you don't believe this particular fact here, but if you believe this one, this constitutes the murder, and that, blah, blah, blah. And they can, and it could be a jeopardy problem with a conviction on alternative theories. I think Buchanan versus Commonwealth is a good case some time ago on that issue. But here, there was a motion to strike which challenges the sufficiency, not the Fifth Amendment problem. Is that a proper way to raise a double jeopardy or multiplicious indictment and force the court to choose which of those two theories at that point? Well, if this has been a jury trial, for instance, the court would have had to send both of those back to the jury.
Yeah. It's an interesting point I hadn't thought of until you raised it today. I don't think it's definitely not an appropriate time to do it. I think probably the appropriate time to do it would be after we have the conviction and the and he's facing punishment.
I mean, the Fifth Amendment only prohibits multiple punishments for the same offense. It doesn't prohibit in a single prosecution multiple prosecutions for the same offense.
All right. I don't know what else to say about it. I do think it was an appropriate time. It was raised and considered.
And the court obviously understood at least what the objection was.
Yeah, and I will concede that the court found it interesting enough to ask the Commonwealth for a response, and the Commonwealth gave it response. This is 279, 280 of the appendix. Probably wasn't the right. I mean, it definitely wasn't the right time to do it. How that affects the case now, I'd have to give some more thought. I don't know. I don't know if it's considering that it was already raised. But the larger point is, even if we get there, I think the case law is pretty clear that this was not a double jeopardy violation. And unless the court has questions, I'd ask that the court affirm.
I think you're ready to come down and agree, counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Apologize. I jumped a little ahead of time. I think we need to add 30 seconds to your. Can we add another 38 seconds, please?
First, I want to address the double jeopardy issue that you guys just got done talking about. I think you do have to, there's an implicit finding of good cause by the judge in this case. The judge is presumed to know the law. The certainly, for the judge to not default him then and there and say, you've already waived this, I think that's meaningful, that he reached the merits of that issue. He asked the Commonwealth for a response, and he not only denied the motion to strike at that point and denied that argument, but he said, I'm denying it because I believe these are two separate offenses. He goes on to say the hammer and the vehicle. So that's a merits ruling, and that's different than what's happened in a lot of the case law. In addition, the Commonwealth, unlike in Williams, some of the other cases, the Commonwealth not only didn't bring this up at trial, but they also did not raise this argument on appeal at all whatsoever until the court noticed us. I want to move to the first assignment of error. The proffer in this case, the record is replete, if you look at 109, 171, of people referring to the house as Zhang's house. There really wasn't a question of whose home that this was. And the proffer need only show what was at issue and so that the court could intelligently make a decision on that. So the proffer was sufficient here, and his inability to show bias of arguably the most critical witness in this case harmed him, and it certainly is not beyond a reasonable doubt that you can say it was harmless. Thank you.
We're going to come down to